We are giving away limited edition Unsolved Mysteries Rewind tinfoil hats on our Facebook group. Head on over to find out how you can receive one of these amazing kits for free. Or you can email us at unsolvedmysteriesrewind@gmail.com.
We cover many serious issues in this podcast. This discussion may contain reference to domestic violence, sexual violence, violence against children, suicide, drug use, or graphic depictions of death or dead bodies. It is not suitable for all audiences.
Tonight on Unsolved Mysteries Rewind, two friends get together to discuss episodes of their favorite television show, Unsolved Mysteries. Will they find answers? Will anyone care? You may be able to solve a mystery.
Hello, you are listening to Unsolved Mysteries Rewind. My name is Mark. I am on today, of course, with Kim. How are you, Kim?
I'm doing so well. Thank you. How are you?
I'm doing great. I chose this episode today because I was so amazed that it was so long. And I think this might be the record of segments in a show for us to have covered. I think we've gotten close in the past. Mm-hmm. But
I feel like I say this every week, but oh my God, there's a lot to uncover in this one.
It's weird because I would watch Unsolved Mysteries and I would just think, oh, there's two stories, three stories. But then when you really look into it, there's a lot of little stuff thrown in, or the updates, or Wanted. There's a lot of stuff going on. So
totally.
Let's just jump into it. It's season 7, episode 6. It originally aired on November 11th, 1994. I decided to look up what else was airing at the same time. This was on the major networks. This was number 3 in the ratings. At the same time, you had Family Matters and Boy Meets World sitcoms on ABC. Then you had Diagnosis Murder, which is kind of weird. Never heard of it. And Mantis. I don't know what that is. Thing is that this was a 2-hour episode, and once you got to 9 p.m., The X-Files kicked on. So I don't know how... I never watched The X-Files when it was on. I still don't really watch it. But it's... I would imagine that The X-Files would have more of a pull than Unsolved Mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
So I just thought it was kind of a strange thing for a Friday night. You're up against sitcoms. And
We have a very special 200th mystery solved on this episode. So I think that's part of the reason they made it a 2-hour one.
Yeah. So there are some big stories here that I never heard of, actually. Being the poison pen. The poison pen is one that just kind of went over my head, and I'm surprised there's not a movie about this.
I've definitely heard about this before.
I've heard of stories like this, but I never heard this specific story.
You know, I used to listen to a certain podcast that covered this, so I think that's probably where I heard it from.
Oh, okay. So how are we going to start this? Do you want me to jump into the first one? Or
yeah, please.
Okay, so we're going to go back to about 1996 in Circleville, Ohio.
1976.
Did I say 1996? What did I say?
I think you did.
Sorry, yeah. 1976. It's okay. It's... a lot of American patriotism. So it's 1976, and we're in Ohio in Circleville, which is just a cute name for this town. It's a small population. You dug up a lot of really amazing things about the town itself, about 13,000 people living there in the 90s. I'm going to imagine that was probably about the same when this was all going on. I can imagine that this would have put Circleville on the map, and people thought, you know, it seems like a good place to move. So people started getting letters mailed to them, and they would be written in these block, would you call it block writing, like handwriting?
Yeah, exactly. Very, big, tall, slow, deliberate writing.
Right.
Like very blocky and square.
And very intentionally, not to have any type of descriptive style, I guess.
Exactly.
Unless you're a lunatic, which is what I'm kind of alluding to. When I get to the end of the story, I'll be alluding to what I think was going on in the mind of this person, because I don't think you can write this much like this without snapping a little bit. So they were receiving letters, and it started out, I'm going to say, somewhat harmlessly, basically stating that there was some type of strange affair going on between.
Mary Gillespie gets one of the first letters, and she's a school bus driver, and it basically hints at the fact, not hints, but outright says that she is having an affair with the superintendent of the schools.
Which is so weird. I mean, you have to think that the superintendent probably doesn't know the bus driver, and, you know, that's her boss. But at the same time, you never know. You know.
Yeah, it's a small little town. I'm sure they're at PTA meetings together and stuff, because she has kids.
Yeah.
And it's like, I am watching you. I know you have kids. Like, you better take this serious.
But you think he'd give her a better job than the bus driver if, you know, he's the superintendent? You know?
I mean, how? It's the perfect cover.
It kind of is. I always thought a school bus driver probably has the best hours in the world. You just kind of go, come home, take a nap in the back of the bus. You know.
Sounds great.
But probably not, though. It's probably awful. It's probably really, really tiring. But anyway, so these letters were basically saying, take this seriously. It's not a joke. Everyone that's concerned will be notified. And they're about to basically blow the whistle on this affair, which, of course, she denies completely.
Yeah, and the envelope is actually postmarked from Columbus, Ohio, which is about a 30-minute drive from Circleville. And, of course, there's no return address. These are all anonymous.
Yeah, and so she kept to herself, and she's kind of went on. They didn't do very much. Do we know how long she got the letters? Like, was it like an ongoing thing right away, or was it like the letter was sent, and then months went by before another one?
Well, within 8 days, she actually got another letter that was like, why haven't you said anything yet? Like, you're supposed to come clean. So she just keeps these letters to herself. She doesn't want to involve her husband, Ron, which to me says, okay, she is having the affair.
Right.
And she doesn't want to admit it to her husband.
But the thing that's weird is it's also somebody who knows them. It's clear, right? You don't know, you know, all right, you might know that an affair is going on, but it doesn't mean that you actually know anything about these people and who they're married to. It's not like the internet where I can just kind of Google somebody and find out that they had a divorce or something.
Yeah, I agree with you, but it is a small town. I think that these people they have a distinguishable truck. Like, I don't know. Obviously, it is somebody that knows these people, like you said, but it's so creepy to think that, like, you got to be looking at everybody differently after that.
Now, the letter started, one of the letters started, "We must inform you." And I thought that it was just weird to address it in the "we," you know. It's kind of like it also could be intentional to make it look like there's a group. But then again, I think all in all, there's not too much thought being put into a lot of this. I think that it's a lot of anger and it's a lot of distrust, but I don't know if there's a lot of thought being put into the outcome of where this might be leading. That's all. I think all of this started out as like a literal, you better stop what you're doing. And then it kind of like, all right, I'll send another one and another one. And then the person snapped. That's what I think.
And then one day her husband, Ron, Mary's husband, Ron, gets a letter from the Circleville writer and saying if he didn't stop the affair that his wife was having, that his life would be in danger. So he kind of brings it to Mary and is like, well, what's this about? And she's like, I've never slept with this guy. Like, we are not having an affair.
Right. Sure.
But I received 2 letters about it, and I just stayed quiet about it.
No. Yeah, exactly. It's like, I'm not hiding anything except for those letters. So now, in the reenactment, they're kind of sitting around having pastries and coffee or something. And it's like a group of friends, and they're talking about these letters, and they decide, well, why don't we write a letter back to the person that we think it might be?
Well, we'll tell you who it is, because this does kind of come in handy. So they confide to a few people. Ron and Mary confide to Ron's sister, Karen, Karen's husband, Paul Freshour, and Paul's sister, who we don't ever know her name.
Mm-hmm.
So like you said, they're going to fight fire with fire. So apparently all these letters were signed with a W, which I don't know. That to me sounds like you're trying to set somebody up. So they're like, you know whose name is W? The superintendent's son's name is William. So they write all these letters. Paul says that he writes 3 or 4 letters that they sent off to William. And I mean, it makes sense in the fact that this person who is writing these letters to me obviously has a vested interest in the superintendent's family and what he does with his life. So, but I mean, to go through all these lengths to disguise yourself, drive to Columbus, mail it and everything, and you're going to sign it with your initial, that's pretty stupid.
Well, not only that, and I agree with you, it's completely stupid, but why not confront the person? Like, you could see on their face if they're guilty, right? I mean, you go up, hey, stop sending me letters, you know, and it's like, whoa, you know, oh, you got those, you know, it's. I don't know. There's a lot of cover-ups here that I don't think that we're learning about. I think maybe the letters were definitely getting a little bit more aggressive. Maybe they were getting a little fearful.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
But I think that they're kind of playing a game by writing back.
Yeah.
So the letters stop. I mean, sorry.
It's a lot of drama.
a little too much drama. You know, it's kind of, like if you were getting letters like this, I mean, I would think the first thing you would do is confront the person.
Yeah, and I think the first thing I would do is probably tell my husband.
right. Even if, exactly. And it seems like these people are kind of loosey-goosey. So it's kind of like, take your lumps. You know, it's maybe you just kind of, you know, if it's true, maybe come out with it. I don't know.
Yeah.
But maybe, you know, stop lying so much. And we do learn that some of this stuff is maybe telling the future. I don't know. Do we believe that? So... One night, middle of summer, well, the end of summer, Ron gets a phone call from, I just want to mention, they did write the letter to W, to William, and it seems as though the letters kind of stopped for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally he gets a phone call. Ron gets a phone call from the letter writer, which is just so weird. Like, how does he know it's the letter writer? What does he sound like? What did he say?
Oh, if I could have been a fly on that wall, like, I would have loved to have known what that conversation was.
Yeah, so Ron grabs his gun. Gets into his really cool red and white truck, and he just drives off. So I don't know where he's going. I don't think he tells anyone who it is, who he thinks it might be, where he's going, or anything.
Nope, nothing.
They described him as, quote-unquote, not drunk, which is just the kind of, it's code for drunk.
Exactly.
he had a few, but not too many.
Exactly. So
it was just tequila.
Before he hops in the car, he grabs his gun and he kisses his two kids goodbye. And I'm guessing that the kids are the ones who said he didn't seem super drunk because they don't show him talking to anybody else on his way. But he ends up losing control of his pickup truck and collides into a tree and he was killed.
Yeah. And you pointed out, I mean, it does kind of sound like drunk driving and kind of just being pissed off and like, I'm going to do this. The weird thing is that they report that the gun went off.
Yeah, so I definitely think he was driving in like a blind rage. You don't grab your gun, storm off, and then, you know, stop at all the stop signs. And, I don't know. It seems like he was just singularly focused. But I found something interesting. I couldn't find the weather for that night, but the newspaper for the next day reported an unusually high number of car accidents. There was actually 7 car accidents that evening.
So you have to wonder. I mean, all right, maybe let's just say it was a really terrible, terrible rainstorm or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you're driving this. You know, these pickup trucks have, you know, lockup type brakes. It's not exactly, you know, there's no protection. Nobody's wearing seatbelts back then.
Oh, yeah, not in 77. But yeah, like you were saying, they determined that one bullet from his gun was fired.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how they know that it didn't happen before that day, because they very specifically say from the time he left his house to the time that he was found, his gun fired one bullet.
You know, this is just the beginning of the amount of lazy policing that we see in this episode, the whole episode. I mean,
I will say that no bullets were ever found inside the vehicle and no bullet was ever recovered from the wreckage.
I mean, they could have swabbed his hand to determine if he fired the gun. There are a number of things that they would have been able to do back in these days. Now, I don't know, in Ohio, is was this an up and coming area? You know, did you have like the Duke boys pull up? And, you know, we don't, I guess it's a small town. They probably have three police. Do they have the means to do this?
I have no idea. Maybe not. I think you're right. I'm getting a very like Mayberry vibe from this.
Yeah, but and which brings us to Sheriff Dwight Radcliffe. And you mentioned they seem to be hinting that there may be a bit of a cover up going on.
Yeah, they're saying like he refused to be interviewed for Unsolved Mystery, but they plaster his picture all over it. But they say the sheriff supposedly investigated and eliminated at least one suspect, and then he ruled Ron Gillespie's death an accident.
Well, eliminated, like, meaning he shot, he might kill the guy in the truck.
Eliminated a suspect, at least one.
It's bizarre. So the letters can. Well, where are we with this?
Yes. So everybody's getting letters now. Like, yeah. Tons of different random people are getting letters that are supposedly threatening to, like, bring the gossip out about this town, which it has to be an exciting time, be it for good or bad. It has to be the most exciting thing that's ever happened in this town.
So this is something I wasn't sure about. Was it gossip about everyone?
Yeah, from what I understand, it was a lot. Like, Mary gets the most attention, Mary and Ron, because of Ron's death, I think. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think everybody had skeletons in their closet that the person was threatening to.
I wonder if it was a type of chain letter type of thing where people were like, well, you know what? I'm going to send my own gossip out. You know, it's easy to emulate
exactly
the way that the letters look.
And they don't all look the same, by the way. Like, the handwriting is different in so many of them. And I think that that everybody got word of this was happening. And they're like, ooh, you know who I hate? Cynthia down at the library. Like, I am going to spill some dirt on her. So I think this kind of snowballed into a bigger town thing than it was.
I could totally see somebody like, huh, you know, like Kim down the road who's making quilts all the time. I don't think they're so nice. So she stole my quilt and tore it apart. No, so it's kind of like, does it turn into like a pettiness with a crime kind of intertwined?
Yeah, and plus you just add all the stereotypes of small town and gossipiness. Like, it just is the perfect storm.
Yeah. Kind of fun, though, like in a way.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate that people are almost being killed and they're going to prison for different things. But at the same time, it's exciting.
Oh, super exciting. Yeah, so... Paul Fresh Shower tells us that. Oh, sorry. No, you've been cutting out this whole time. I've just been running with it. Paul's brother-in-law, or Paul Fresh Hour, says that the sheriff told him that it was foul play at first, but then he said that no foul play was suspected and that the suspect passed a polygraph test.
Yeah, I think we agree that polygraph tests are just kind of roll your eyes one way or the other.
And again, especially in 1977.
But let me ask you, all right, in your opinion, right, we both agreed that polygraph tests are kind of fan fiction in some ways. But when the person comes out as negative, does that make you lean towards that they're lying?
There are so many ways to, I don't know. My aunt,
I'm saying you personally.
No, I'm just saying my aunt took one and supposedly was telling the truth and it failed and she got fired because something was stolen from work or something. So I've always been skeptical, but they could have just been telling me that she was innocent. She was guilty the whole time. Plus, I personally have like super high anxiety, so I fear polygraph testing because I don't know how my reactions would be.
Yeah, I have a very guilty conscience. So I would think.
I do too.
What's your name? I don't know. What? You tell me. You
know, I would be like, is this good? So I'm lying? I don't know.
Right. Is this going to turn into like a letter writing campaign? So it went on for 6 years. I mean, this isn't like 6 weeks, you know, that, and 6 weeks would be a long time. 6 years, you know, this is, you know, we're into the 80s now.
And just to clarify one more thing on Ron, he did have a blood alcohol content of 0.16, which is double the legal driving limit. I think it's a little higher in Ohio, but just to show he was drinking.
Now, what was that number in the last episode that you were saying where if you're at this point, you can actually choke to death on your own vomit?
It was like from 0.20 to 0.30.
So he might have been kind of close, really, to that.
Especially if he's not a drinker. You know,
or maybe he is, you know, it's, I think when people are saying, well, he wasn't drunk, yeah, I just think it's a red flag that he's a heavy drinker.
Exactly. That's very true. But yeah, like you said, 6 years later, we're in 1983, and Mary Gillespie's like, oh, you know what? The superintendent and I are totally involved, but it only started after the letters, and it kind of pushed us together.
Which is weird, because you could see, again, the PTA meeting, and it's like they see each other at the punch, you know, bowl, and they're like, you know, that rumor, it's flying around for the past 6 years.
And then it gets just hot and heavy.
Yeah, I wonder if, like, you know, do they kind of, I almost can believe that that is somewhat true.
Oh, I don't buy it for
No, me either, but I love the idea of it, though. If it's true, I just think it's hilarious, that's all.
Yeah.
Now, in the reenactment, she's driving her bus, and she sees a sign with her name, and it says...
With her daughter's name.
No, in the reenactment, wasn't it her name? Daughter's name on that. All I noticed is that the person's name, it said, that person sucks.
Yeah, it says Tracy Gillespie sucks, and she's like, oh, hell no. So she goes over, like, pulls her bus over and goes to yank down the sign.
And as she's pulling in, she sees a rope, which is connected to this kind of this box. She pulls it down. I just think it's weird that she's kind of yanking on all this, kind of what they expected and what they maybe they were hoping to do. She opens this what appears to be a pretty dirty, gross box, and there's a gun in it, and it appears to be some type of weapon that when you pull the rope, it would fire and kills her. Well, it doesn't kill her, but it would kill her or shoot at her. One shot, literally.
Exactly. And the serial numbers were like mostly scratched off of the gun, but the forensics lab was able to re-raise the serial numbers.
Look, you can barely see the numbers. It'll be fine.
But who does the gun belong to?
I forgot his name already.
Paul Freshour. Paul.
Yeah. Paul will become, I don't know. I don't know if Paul's completely innocent in this whole thing, but I know that he lost a lot. I'll say that much. He seems to be a nice guy. I don't know. But Paul Freshour is, he's the ex-brother-in-law. So he's deeply involved in this, but it's his gun. It's literally the smoking gun.
And let's just throw out there that apparently Paul caught Karen, his wife, cheating on him. And keep in mind, Karen is Ron's sister. And they were all, when they went to go write the letter to William. So Paul caught Karen cheating on him. And because of this, they got a divorce. And it was so ugly. And because of the adultery, he got everything, including the house and the custody of the kids.
I'm going to say this is kind of not a common trend, especially for the time, for the man to end up getting everything, including custody. So this had to be pretty bad. There had to be some real damning evidence against her. Maybe, you know, an affair with the superintendent would do that. We also don't know who he was married to, if he was married.
And the superintendent?
Yes.
Right.
Do we?
Right.
The superintendent's spouse is not involved in this, right?
I mean, I've never seen anything, but like, who has the most motive to me is the superintendent's wife.
Or the son.
But I mean, stay away from him. And this kind of like psychological torture to me just says scorned woman. Like, that was my first instinct.
Now, normally this is where the story would be like, oh, wow, this is a crazy story. It just goes away. But no. Paul is called into the sheriff's office for questioning. This is in the spring of 1983. And they give him a handwriting test. And I don't know. If I was called in all of a sudden for years about all of this, he seems to be very trusting. He just kind of goes along with it. I would lawyer up, personally. But, you know what? Again, small town in Ohio.
Yeah, but that was a good instinct because it turns out in the fall of 1983, he actually goes on trial for the attempted murder of Mary for the booby trap.
Yeah, which kind of blows me away a lot. All right, I can understand that they want to look at this guy and they want to research everything, right? But just because it's his gun doesn't necessarily mean, I mean, he seems to have a pretty good alibi.
Well, they keep saying that he has an alibi. They never tell us what that alibi is because at court, it comes out that he did not show up to work that day. And so that's definitely suspicious. But what's interesting to note is in August of 1982, and this is according to Mary Gillespie's testimony, during the divorce between Karen and Paul, Karen actually moved out onto a trailer in, on Mary's property. Mm-hmm. And Karen came to Mary and said that Paul is the one behind the letters, or that he may be the one behind the letters. So Mary told the sheriff, and 2 weeks later, Paul was actually arrested.
It seems so weird to me. The whole, the whole thing
again,
is very...
something an interesting kind of side note.
He said, she said at this
after,
point?
Yeah, but after Paul was incarcerated, she got possession of the house, custody of the kids, and his pension.
Yeah. So, I mean, he actually went on trial for the attempted murder, which I just think is crazy. And he did not take the stand, which I never understand. Why don't you want to just go up there and tell your story, right?
Because then you can be cross-examined.
I guess. Yeah, you're right. I'd probably get life, probably.
Well, supposedly what happened was that the prosecutor said, if he doesn't testify, we are going to bring like 40 to 50 letters in. If he does testify, then we can bring in up to 1,000 of these letters, because there are thousands of them. And I guess that for whatever reason, his team thought it was better if they went with the shorter amount of letters.
And they couldn't find any evidence in these thousands of letters. Something. I don't know. It just seems to me that it's... For one thing, it's attempted murder. At this point, no one is dead. And they're really treating it like there it was an actual murder.
Yeah,
I mean, do you think that's kind of strange?
Well, he's sentenced to 7 to 25 years.
He's found guilty.
Yeah.
For attempted murder. I mean, nobody's even dead. I mean, you may as well kill the person. I feel like you would get a similar sentence.
Well, this is not anything that we endorse as a podcast.
No, but I almost feel like, all right, he's a disgruntled spouse and he's mad and he kills her. All right, go to prison for 25 years.
I mean, he had the opportunity to parole out, but while he is in prison, these letters are still coming.
Yeah.
Bam, bam, bam. And they're all still postmarked from Columbus. But Paul is in prison in Lima, Ohio, which is actually an hour and a half drives away. So in December 1990, he's in front of the parole board. But in the weeks leading up to the parole, there are more letters than ever. So because of this, he's actually denied parole. And the warden comes on and is like, it is impossible for him to send these. He is in solitary confinement. We go through all of his letters incoming and outgoing. Like, there's no way that Paul's sending them. But the parole board's like, too bad, so sad. So he actually stays in jail for a few more years.
It blows me away that the parole board wouldn't take that into consideration.
Yeah. It's bananas. Like, they should have. I think, like you said, it's just a case of just wanting to wrap everything up with a pretty little bow. But Martin Yant, who is like the driving force behind this whole thing, he's a private, like a journalist investigator. He uncovered some evidence that never made it to trial. Apparently, another bus driver was driving on the same road with the Tracy Gillespie sucks sign and the booby trap.
Yeah.
20 minutes before Mary found the booby trap. And in that spot, she saw a yellow El Camino with like a large sandy haired man standing near the booby trap where it was later found. But when he saw her, he kind of turned and just acted like he was just peeing in the woods.
Right. at the very like spot, you know, that's, I don't know. Everybody seems to have these kind of weird things. And a yellow El Camino, it can't be too hard to find. We know that somebody, actually, there is a yellow El Camino in the mix of all of the people.
Yeah, it's alleged that Karen's brother has a yellow El Camino, Karen Paul's ex-wife. And I personally think she has the most to gain with him going away.
There's no doubt about it. I definitely think that, you know, she got the house back. She got the pension. She... Now, I have to wonder when... at one point, Paul was released, I believe, after 10 years.
Yeah, 1994, he got parole in 94. Yeah, so 10 years, yeah.
Does he continue, I mean, does he get back his property, do you think? Or does he get back his pension?
Oh, I doubt it.
Why? I just feel like if, it just seems weird to me that he would just relinquish all of this to her. Ownership.
I don't think he had a choice.
Yeah, but he could have sold it and banked it.
Yeah, but I don't think you're allowed to do that once it's, like, in the court's hands. Like,
well, it's an estate. You know, it's I'm just like throwing it out there. It seems weird to me. You know, it's, you know, like if I were to go to prison, I don't have to give somebody my house. You know, it just, as long as the taxes are paid on it.
Yeah,
and the mortgage. Know. Yeah. I don't know. I think that there's something weird there, and I'm not really sure. It's kind of, if there is a pension that exists, I would just imagine that he would receive it or not. You know, like either it would be dissolved completely and even, you know, and no one would get it. Just, it just seems very strange to me.
Yeah, I really don't know about like the legalness of pensions and stuff, but recent information from the this is from the Unsolved Wiki. Recent information was uncovered by Martignat that others were involved. There's at least three letter writers involved in the case, according to Martignat. One was believed to be William, who the son of the superintendent. The second was believed to be David Longberry, who we'll come back to. And the third is believed to be Paul's ex-wife, Karen, because who had the motive, you know, to or who had the resources to get his gun, motive to set him up? Like, to me, a lot of it points to her. But David Longberry is a man who lived with this old couple, and allegedly he raped their 11-year-old granddaughter. So the grandpa goes to confront him, and he actually goes on the run for a few years until he hanged himself with suicide in 2003. But after 2003, that's when the last Circleville letter was received. So it never happened after he died. So sadly, Paul Freshour died in 2012. He has a website called CircleVilleLetters.wordpress.com where you can see court transcripts, letters, like everything, all his evidence that he has.
Yeah.
But I do want to give credit where credit's due. I got a lot of this extra information from a podcast that is awesome called the Dark Histories Podcast. They had more information than I've seen before, so just wanted to shout out to them.
Oh, that's awesome. That's another podcast I have to look into. There's so many out there.
Yeah.
But yeah, CircleVilleLetters.wordpress.com is kind of a weird site. I don't know. I was reading through it. I guess it's good to get the stuff out there. I'm just not really sure. Is it just out there to put it publicly?
I think he just wants to show that he's innocent.
Yeah. Well, he's dead. So he's, yeah. He passed away 8 years ago. So
yeah.
I don't know who's, well, I guess you don't have to maintain it anymore. It's on the WordPress.com thing. So I guess whenever they decide to take it down, it's gone. Hopefully somebody's archiving it.
Yeah, definitely. I think his brother's involved, so I'm sure his brother has a lot of information. But speaking of people who are dead, we have Agatha Christie's story next.
Yeah. Agatha Christie is, of course, a famous writer. She had a lot of history. She lived a pretty interesting life. I don't know. Were you ever a fan of her writing?
No, I mean, I don't have anything against her, but I've never read anything.
Yeah, it's always been a little bit over my head, to be honest with you. But I've attempted to read it, and one of these days I'm hoping to jump into it. But she's one of these just legendary writers and kind of lived a pretty interesting life. And we get a very long segment to learn a lot about Agatha Christie.
Yeah, we'll condense this the best way we can. But basically, she grew up in like upper crust British family. And she marries a man named Archie, and he goes off to war. So in her spare time, she decides to start writing, and she becomes a successful author, which is an understatement.
Mm-hmm.
After he comes home from war, they have a daughter, Rosalind, and he's just like boring, dependable, stable guy. And she is looking for some more excitement. So she is like so over her marriage. She is so bored. And in 1926, her mother dies, and her marriage just like, that was the straw that broke the camel's back. So she moves to her childhood home with her daughter and a nanny to like kind of pick through, pack up the mother's belongings. But she's like, I'm just going to stay here. Like, it's better than going back to Archie. So Archie came to visit for Rosalind, their daughter's birthday. And he was like, I want a divorce. This is crazy. We're not living together. We're not happy. Oh, and by the way, I met a new lady named Nancy Neal, and I want to marry her. So I need you to give me a divorce.
Oh, my God.
So Agatha's like, well, I don't want you, but I sure don't want Nancy to have you. So she's like, let's move back home and we'll make it work. So she is like desperately trying to save a marriage she doesn't want to be in at this point. And on December 3rd of 1926, Archie takes off and leaves Agatha behind. So Around 9:30 p.m., she, quote, left in a state, and she just took an overnight bag with her. And she also left behind two notes, one asking her secretary to cancel her weekend appointments and another one addressed to Archie.
She's very famous at this point, by the way. I just want to say has the means to go and do whatever she wants. And both of them, really. I mean, the family has wealth. And she grew up wealthy. Mm-hmm. So I don't even... So it's one of those things where it's just like very dramatic and very, I'm just going to go and vacation in Paris.
Exactly. And maybe she is until they find that her car was kind of like run off the road a little bit. It was upright, but it wasn't working. So Archie just happens to be driving by at this point and they're like, it's the husband and he's checking on the crime scene. So he must have done it. So police are dragging the pond. They search all through the woods. They actually had over 1,000 police officers and 15,000 volunteers, and even airplanes helped search for her.
What I found kind of interesting here is that she actually drove the car herself.
Yeah.
Because these cars are not easy to drive. Not to say that you couldn't handle it. It's just, I don't know, I cannot picture an upper crust fancy lady driving one of these stinky cars.
Well, apparently she didn't drive it very well because A, it was run off the side of the road, and B, some man had to come help her who was just like walking on his way to work and was like, good day, mom, can I help you? You know, so he like starts cranking up her car and she's like, oh, thank you, sir, thank you. So she takes off in the opposite direction of where the car is later found. So 11 days later, a musician at this like fancy spa notices Agatha Christie because she's a celebrity, like you said.
Yeah, of course.
And the musician called the authorities. So the police came with Archie. Meanwhile, everybody thinks Archie has killed her at this point. And she was like, oh, brother. And he's like, brother, I'm your husband. What are you talking about, lady? So
this reminded me of Billy Zane in Titanic when they come and rescue the girl who's slipped or something, you know. I just felt like it was so dramatic. It was very reenacted nicely. And it was fun to watch, I guess. But it's a real nothing story. She might have popped her head, banged her head, and had amnesia.
Well, the press says that she has amnesia, but I am thinking this is like the original Gone Girl. She knows how to write mysteries. She was pissed at her husband for taking up with this other lady. I think she tried to set him up for murder. Meanwhile, she's just like doing the Charleston, you know, all over town. But the interesting thing is that she actually checks into hotels using the name Tressa Neal, which is the last name of his side chick. So they get a quick divorce and she remarries a guy named Max and he marries
That is so funny. It's such an FU. You know, it's one of those kind of like, I don't know. I don't know about it. This makes me like Agatha Christie a little bit more. I'm not that I disliked her. I just really kind of off my radar. So I'm just kind of wondering if this kind of sarcasm and bitterness and nastiness kind of carries over to her writing.
Oh, we'll have to check it out.
Yeah. And I don't know. It just seems to me that it was a great story for Unsolved Mysteries, but it's not really something that's that big of a deal.
Yeah, and it didn't need to take a lot of time it took.
Now, moving into Vietnam, I guess, the Vietnam War, we have Mitchell Shigemoto. He joins the Army in 1964. And as you pointed out, this is the 200th solved mystery or just the 200th mystery?
Solved.
And they make kind of a big deal about it for Unsolved Mysteries, and they should. I think that's kind of a big...
They go to the telecenters and they show us like all the lost loves that have been reunited over the years.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Now, in 1964, I guess, as with any type of period of time, Vietnam War, Asian people probably had a really, really tough time, even if they are not Vietnamese.
Yeah.
Just kind of like this Asian type of hatred, really. So because he was Asian, he was having these issues and soldiers just really weren't supporting him in the way that they should have been.
Yeah, they were like calling him racist.
Oh, man, it was terrible.
It was horrible.
But one soldier stood up, James Pearson. And in any type of situation like this, they found kind of rapport with each other because maybe they had each other's backs. And I think it's really great that James would stand up for Mitchell, even though it was not a popular type of opinion. I hope that all of us hopefully you're this type of person. I think I'm this type of person, and we just have to be this way more and more and more. Now, 2 years later, you know, this, they're still in war. As we know, the Vietnam War was going on for a very long time, and they were in heavy fire, and Mitchell gets shot. And James is right there. You know, it's like his, you know, as you pointed out, they're BFFs now. Mm-hmm. And a sniper was, you know, really taking them out. If you've ever played Call of Duty, you know that these guys are kind of relentless, especially mm-hmm. the snipers. So James is really putting himself in front of the line of fire to protect Mitchell.
Yeah, he like lays down around him to protect Mitchell from getting shot anymore.
It's like, oh, it's amazing. Look, you already stood up for him. You don't need to get killed for it, buddy.
You've done enough.
No, but you know, it's just one of these type of things where it really maybe tells us a little bit about the kind of person that James Pearson remained to be. Like, you know, yeah. I'm going to say he's still a kid here. I'm going to say they're pretty young.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They were both born in like 47, 48.
So they're like 20. You know, it's yeah, crazy. So, but he has the nerve to actually do this, and he puts himself on the line.
And he actually breaks the rules because he leaves his post to carry Mitchell to safety.
Yeah. It's crazy because he really, by doing that, he does put other people at risk. But he just felt at this period of time, this is the right thing to do. This is something I need to do. And he basically saved his life. You know, he basically took Mitchell to safety. And the next thing you know, they were sent home. And that's it. I mean, decades go by.
Well, yeah, Mitchell was sent home because he was injured. James stayed in Vietnam.
So, oh, you know what? I missed that.
Yeah, so they never saw each other ever again. And so we have the original story. I'm not sure when that was recorded, where he is looking for the guy who saves his life. He says his wife's tried. She's had no luck. So a week after it was airing, this viewer was like determined to reunite these two. And he found James in Chicago.
Which is crazy. I mean, nowadays, of course, we have the internet and everything. But, mm-hmm. you know, it's really sweet. James, I believe, flies out to Hawaii.
Oh, yeah, I cried. Oh,
yeah. I mean, it's, I don't know. They seemed a little bit shy at first, which I mean, the cameras are there. They genuinely went through some serious stuff together.
And it's been 30 years.
So, I mean, I'm not saying I would be able to be all charismatic or something in front of the camera. It's just, it was almost cute to see these two grown men back together after these decades of being in this terrible, terrible situation. And
they had the biggest smiles. And the producer asked James, like, how do you feel? And he's like, I'm so happy. There's not a word that's been invented yet that I could use to describe my
feelings. That's right. I forgot about that.
Oh, so good.
But the good news is Mitchell is still alive. So is James, mm-hmm. we think. They both seem to have aged well, I think.
James looks just the same as he did in 94. Like, I know it's an older pic that I found, but I didn't find any death records on him or anything. So Mitchell is 74. He is a great grandfather. And I believe the same is for James. He is 75.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, they definitely, I mean, even though they went through this terrible, terrible, you know, Vietnam, it's, they seem, they're smiling. And that's really great, I think. So I mean, we got to see them. Hopefully they stayed close even to today. I hope so.
I'm going to believe they did. But this next story will not leave you with such a warm and fuzzy feeling. A lot of the research I got from this is the Unsolved Mysteries Wiki, which is unsolvedmysteries.fandom.com. And just to say, like, I get a lot of info from there. If you're an Unsolved Mysteries fan, go check it out.
Yeah, it's a real rabbit hole type place. You know, there's always somewhere to, always something to read. It's really crazy.
And I'm going to go through these events chronologically, which is different than how Unsolved Mysteries did it, but I think it makes more sense.
This segment upset the hell out of me, though. The amount of corruption and the laziness. That's all. I just wanted to say that.
At first, I didn't think it was corruption, to be honest with you. I thought it was parents in denial. But when I dug deeper, I thought it was corruption.
I think it's also parents in denial. I don't know if they're seeing the big picture, but I think I think it's a mixture of a lot of different things.
Yeah, we have 21-year-old Tommy Burkett, and he is a junior at Marymount University. But he's home because it's just like November, December. He's home for the Thanksgiving, Christmas break. His mother is Beth George. She is an instructor at the campus. And his father is Tom Burkett Sr. On November 12th, 1991, Tommy is at school and he calls his mom, who's at home. He says that, quote, they smashed his mailbox at school and took his paycheck. And they may have taken something that he, quote, didn't want anybody else to know about. He said, I think they found out what I'm doing. So Beth is like, what are you talking about? And he's like, I'm not going to tell you. I don't want to go into it any deeper. So because Beth works there on November 14th, she's just walking to class and she sees these three toughs. Now, allegedly, one of them is the son of a police officer and the other one is a grandson of a trustee of the college. And they say, oh, if you see Tommy, tell him that we want to beat him up, which is a weird thing to say to the person's mom, but okay.
Yeah, yeah. It's also very juvenile, I guess is the word.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, I mean, they're 20s guys. Yeah. They're going to be tough. So on the next day, on November 15th, Tommy actually confronts the police officer's son and is like, what is this all about? What are you doing to me? And they pounce on him, kick him, beat him. They said he was unrecognizable. His face was so swollen from this accident or incident. So here we get to a tighter timeline. On November 30th, 1991, at 8 p.m., Tommy arrives at his friend's house, which is about 7 miles from his parents' house. Keep in mind, he's home now for the holidays. About midnight on the morning of December 1st, so a few hours later, he withdraws cash from the ATM, and the ATM shows Tommy being approached by three white men. Now, at 2 a.m., Tommy calls his parents and says that he's going to stay the night at his friend's house, but he'll be home by noon. So it's like 11:45 a.m., and Tommy's parents leave to run some errands, and they say at this time they heard tires screeching, but they didn't see anything. Now, later we'll learn that, well, I'm not going to spoil it.
Well, okay, let me ask you, you know, it seems like Tommy, all in all, when it really comes down to it, he really respects his parents to keep them in the loop, like calling them at 2 a.m. saying, look, you know, just I'm safe, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It just, but I definitely think that your comment earlier needs to be remembered, that they found something about what he's doing and how he didn't want to address that.
Definitely. Yeah. So keep that in your mind. But his parents eventually return home from the little errands that they're running and they don't see Tommy. So it's 2:45 p.m. He said he'd be home by noon. And the parents are like, we got to go to this event. They were going to go with Tommy, but because he wasn't anywhere to be found, they had to go without him. So while they're gone, witnesses say that they saw a white man in a dark sedan parked three houses down from the Burkett's house, like horizontally blocking the entrance to the cul-de-sac for 20 minutes.
That's a little bit weird, and I'm surprised no one did anything about this.
I am too. This neighborhood screams homeowners association to me. Like, I'm shocked nobody did anything.
Like, you're not doing that around here or probably near you either. It's strange.
Yeah, so at like 5:10, we meet a witness named Debbie. Debbie says her friend was visiting her, and while they're outside, they see Tommy's blue Mustang driving around the cul-de-sac like crazy, reckless, screeching, Tokyo drifting, and the lights were off.
Yeah, and this is 5:10, so it's, you know, it's dark, right?
In the wintertime, yeah. So they stood out on the porch, and they're talking about it for a minute, and they're just staring at the guy in the car, and they're like, whatever. So they finally go inside, and only after they went inside did the driver get out of the car. So it's 6:10 p.m. now, and his parents arrive home. They are looking for Tommy everywhere, so they go into his bedroom and they discover Tommy's body. He is dead.
Every parent's nightmare right there.
I can't imagine. Yeah, he's sitting upright. He has his legs crossed and he has a gun like loosely in his hand and his hands are in his lap. He's actually been shot through the mouth. The police are like, this is an obvious suicide. And his parents think instantly that he was murdered. So
I mean, you think this is murder, right? I mean, this isn't suicide.
If I saw that, I would think it was suicide. As somebody with a gun in their hand, with a gunshot to the mouth, like that to me screams suicide.
But what about the revolver? I know I'm jumping a little ahead, but as soon as you saw that the cylinder was unlatched on the gun.
I don't know. I mean, to me, all this, nothing points to murder yet. Nothing conclusively. Okay.
Not even the cylinder being open?
No, I think that could happen if it falls out of his hand, hits his knee or something.
But he was holding it.
But he was holding it, but his hands would drop into his lap.
I don't know.
He's
holding it up. Every single time that I've ever held like a
drop.
I think every single time that I've ever held like a 38 revolver, in order to pull that pin and open that cylinder is not something that would just loosely happen.
Okay.
That's all. Just my own personal. But you know what? Maybe it's a piece of crap gun, and you're right. It's possible that if there is enough play in the pin, it could pop open.
And don't get me wrong. I think that he probably was murdered, but I'm just saying if I saw this and I'm a parent and I instantly see this and I'm blocking everything else out, but the simple things that I see, that's what I would think. But Beth walks over to him, grabs his hand, and is like, "We will find who did this to you." So she instantly thought it was a murder.
Right.
So now it's 6:20 p.m., and here's where things get crazy. Paramedics arrive. Two ambulances are sent to their house. Witnesses saw the first ambulance turn down a street that was adjacent to the Burkett Street and stop by the curb. Then people got out of the ambulance, retrieved something from a small ravine, and drove away slowly without their sirens on, and they never went to the Burkett
Street. That's crazy.
That screams cover up. Yes. So we would later find out that there were footprints leading from their back door down to the ravine, but the police never, you know, took notice of those. They never cast it or anything. So a paramedic arrives and the paramedic tells Beth, the mom, that Tommy has been dead for several hours. And Beth says at this point, police officer like literally runs upstairs and just says, "Don't blame yourself. College students kill themselves all the time."
Oh, I hated it. I hated it so much.
It's so, like you said, cringy. So yeah. The lead detective also runs up to Tommy's room. And apparently they're up there for a minute. And the parents say that the detective came down with an old deposit slip. And on there was like crudely scribbled out, just said, "I want to be cremated."
It's almost like he may as well be putting the pen away as he's walking down the stairs. I mean, he clearly wrote this.
Exactly. And Beth's like, "That's not my son's handwriting." And the detective said, "Oh my God, he's actually just been dead for a few minutes. He probably shot himself like as you guys were turning onto your street."
It's the worst thing to say, right?
Oh yeah.
Like, oh yeah, he was alive when you were down at that stop sign, but by the time you were here.
Yeah. Dead. Too bad you couldn't come home a little sooner, huh?
Touch him. He's still warm. You know, it's the worst possible thing that a detective should say.
And Tom Sr. says that Tommy was cold, stiff, and the blood had dried. He was like, "I haven't gone to detective school, but you don't have to be super genius to find out that this body wasn't just dead a few minutes."
Now, this is where we start to hear more from the parents, from Beth.
Yes.
Her demeanor is so calm that I am almost, it's a little frightening.
I see, like, a quiet determination. She knows if she comes out and looks rabid that nobody's going to buy what she says. Yeah. I think she is making herself be calm.
But, you know, I found it a little unsettling how, not in a bad way, really. Just, I feel bad for her, really. I mean, that's basically where I'm going with it. It's just she's so, I don't think that she's a part of this. I just think, she's focused and, really just calm and collected.
Yeah, I think she probably had to compartmentalize her emotions. And, you know, it is 3 years after his death. But I think that she has had to wade through so much stuff, like grab autopsy pictures, fight for every single thing that they had, that she's like, "I can't cry about this until it's over."
Yeah.
So I think she is very calm and cool. But Tom noted that when he found the body, Tommy's body, he had actually had torn clothing and multiple cuts and bruises. So we get to meet Major Art Mabry, and he is the spokesperson for the police department. And basically everything that Tommy's parents say, he's just there to negate and be like, "Oh, no, it was fine. No, they did a thorough investigation. Don't worry about it."
What's your opinion of Art Mabry? In your opinion, do you, like, what, just looking at his body language and his eye movement and when he answers questions, what do you think?
I think that he is aggravated that these parents are being a thorn in his side. I think he probably knows more than what he's saying, and I think that he is doing this without conscience.
I think he's lying a lot. I think he's flat out lying. I don't believe him. And they even leave the camera on in one shot where he, I forget what he says. It's like, well, we've done everything we can and blah, blah, blah. And then you see him like look away, almost like, did you buy that? I don't believe him. I think that there's, I think he's showing every sign of, maybe he's not lying, but I don't think he believes what he's saying.
Yeah, and he's his number one goal is to protect the police department.
Yes.
You know, he is not interested in finding the actual answer. So we find out that Tommy's glasses, wallet, and driver's license were missing, and the police never dusted the room. They never looked in the Mustang.
Why bother?
Yeah, exactly. Open and shut suicide. So December 3rd, 1991, this is a few days later, and his parents go to the college to collect all his stuff at the dorm. So a school administrator comes in and is like, oh, hey, a student found this and I thought you should have it. And it's Tommy's driver's license. So they're like, who gave this to you? And she's like, don't worry about it. Like, I'm not really allowed to tell you. But it's later found out that it is the very son of the police officer who gave it to her, the son who we were talking about before.
Now, can you imagine you're being handed this? You know, something that would be on all of us. When you leave the house, you're carrying your license and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it just magically appears in the university. And you won't, and the administrator won't even, like, share with you. I mean, I'm assuming they had to go through a lawful way of receiving that information. They probably had to subpoena them.
Oh, I totally agree. And, you know, in my mind, the school administrator was probably like, if I tell these parents, they will go and kill him. And maybe he did just find it. Like, I don't have enough evidence to tell them what it is.
That's true. I just feel as though in this situation, it all just has to be disclosed. And it was. I mean, because you did find out.
Yeah, eventually it was. So the parents are like, we're going to canvass the neighborhood at home because obviously the police don't care enough to do it. So several neighbors said that, you know, around the time that the parents left for errand running that morning and they heard the screeching tire, they saw Tommy's car, the blue Mustang, chased by a large dark car. Now, Tommy's car was allegedly run off the road and he was assaulted by the people who were chasing them. He was able to break free from them and he ran on foot back to his house. So when canvassing the neighborhood, everyone's like, no, the police never took my statement. One person says, I went up to the police officer and they were like, don't worry about it. Like, we got everything we need.
It's just lazy. It really is just crazy to me that the police were just kind of phoning it in.
And above phoning it in, too, I agree with you, but they were actively lying because they say, oh, we talked to all the neighbors. Like, they said they did the car. They said that they took care of his room. Like, none of that was done.
At the very least, you dust for prints. I mean, there are so many. You know what is also sad is that a lot of evidence comes out way after the fact.
Yeah. Yeah, and what's interesting and, like, devastating to me is that the parents never went in his room again, never touched it, because they were like, when the police see that they did wrong, we're going to have the crime scene exactly how it was left.
Yeah, so but you can't even prove that. You know, it's just bizarre. I mean, it's like some type of crypt that they have now. It's terrible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so, like, a few weeks after the death, Beth notices that there's some droplets of blood on the wall in the stairway. And she's like, how did that get here? She says she also noticed some blood downstairs. So she told the police, and police were like, you know, better grab some Windex and, like, take care of that, basically. I mean, I'm being a jerk, but basically.
No, but, I mean, they basically didn't seem to have much of an interest of coming out and investigating.
Exactly, yeah. And so the parents are like, we're going to have to do this ourselves. They exhume Tommy's body.
No, how do you do this? We've spoken about this in the past about exhuming bodies. I don't think you can just say, hey, dig them back up. Don't you have to have some lawful reason?
That's a great question, and I would love to find the answer out about that. Like, I don't know. I'm guessing, I mean, he belongs to
I don't mean to just throw that at you. It's just, I cannot imagine that I can just dig up grandma because I feel like it. You know,
yeah, but maybe like grandma's parents could. Maybe it's different. I don't know.
Well, grandma's parents, that would be my great grandparents. No. So another thing is there's so much mismanagement going on. There just seems to be so much strangeness. Why don't they I mean, it's easy to say now, but call the FBI at this point. Like, it's obviously above the pay grade of the police department that's in your local town.
You know, knowing Beth, as I don't, but, you know, just from my read on her, I bet she probably did, and they probably told her the same thing, you know? So they had a second autopsy done on Tommy, and they show that he had bruising and abrasions around his right ear and a broken jaw.
Yeah.
Now, to me, gunshot wound in the mouth, seems like that would happen. So the parents hire bloodstain expert Paul Kish. Paul Kish comes, and he, like, is looking at the blood on the wall and downstairs, and he determines that it was a man's blood, but he couldn't tell if it was Tommy's blood.
Which is strange, of course. Why can't they determine if it's actually Tommy's? I mean, I'm asking rhetorical questions in a way. It's like, how do we know? But it seems like a weird outcome. Also, do we know how much time had passed from Tommy's death to exhuming the body?
No.
Yeah, no, I couldn't find that either.
That's a great question. I imagine that if you're doing a second autopsy, it has to be pretty soon after.
Yeah, I would imagine, especially if you're talking about bruising and abrasions.
Yeah, exactly. And what's interesting is that they go home. Somebody finds that there was a spent bullet in Tommy's room wall. But when Paul Kish looked at it, he said that there was no tissue or blood on it, as would happen if it was the bullet that he shot himself with, because it's going through your mouth, your brain, whatever, and it's going to have some remnants of that on there. So Beth decides to call the police and see if they had any record of Tommy calling 911. And apparently he had called 911 twice. So the records about what he called about were deleted, like, as luck would have it.
Now, I looked into this a little bit. When you call 911, I don't know about today, but in the early 80s, they have to make a physical log of what you're saying and all of the information. So you can't just, you're not relying just on the call, you know, just on the audio. Another thing is, these aren't recorded on 90-minute tapes. These are recorded on probably 12 to 24-hour tapes, and they're archived for a very long time.
Yeah. Ugh, this was so frustrating. And so she said, oh, you know what, Tommy, the dispatcher said, Tommy also made two complaints to the police, one in August and one in October, but I can't see that information either. So let me put you on hold. I'm going to check with my supervisor and see if I can get those messages back. So the mom's waiting on hold.
She's lucky she didn't get fired, right?
Yeah, exactly. And when the dispatcher comes back, she tells the mom, oh my God, is my face red.
Like, did you say Tom?
Yeah, exactly. She's like, oh, it's such a big misunderstanding. No, he never called 911.
Oh my God.
I know. So then we get good old Art Mabry, and he's like, well, he didn't make the police, or if he did, it was erased because of how much time had passed.
Which is nonsense.
It's nonsense, but he says the information that the Burkettes came up with about the 911 calls, which to me makes it seem like he's saying that they're lying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I don't know why they can't look on their phone bill if he called 911 or not, but we meet Melinda Nerber, who is a reporter, and tells us that it's possible that Tommy was actually a drug informant on campus.
And this is where things start to make sense, I think.
Yeah, so Beth and Tom's theory, in a nutshell, is that Tommy was a paid DEA informant. The bad guys found out and chased him down. And so when Tommy left his car and he was, like, on foot, he ran home and called 911. So a few weeks after Tommy died, Beth says that they noticed that their phone books were missing, and that they noticed that Tommy's baseball bat was also missing the gripping tape on the handle. So they're basically saying that the guys, you know, beat him up, covered his body with phone books, which I thought was kind of weird, and then beat him to, like, absorb the sound and to absorb some of the blood.
Yeah, this is like a total mafioso type thing.
This is bonkers.
You would put it, you know, you would basically hold them down, put the phone book on his head and just bash it, and you would get all the impact.
Oh, okay. See,
yeah, or anything. You know, it's a total, total, like, mob type thing, which is really crazy, because we're thinking that kids are involved. I don't think kids are doing this.
Interesting. Well, you know, we get an update, kind of, not really, but Police are still saying it's a suicide. Tommy's parents still think it's a murder. And the DEA deny that Tommy ever worked for them. But to me, I hear what you say about it seeming like a more like middle-aged kind of mafia type crime. That you
Well, or at least somebody who's got real issues. No, it just doesn't seem like it doesn't seem smart enough for these kids.
Yeah, but like the police cover-up angle to me does scream,
well,
son of a police officer or something, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I almost want to, I mean, I hate to say it, but it almost seems as though the police might be involved on this level. We're probably talking about a lot of money if the DEA is involved.
Yeah, and it's like right by Washington, D.C. There was another Washington, D.C. like drug informant who was found murdered similar time. The autopsy doctor was the same guy in both cases. Like, there is a big conspiracy out there. But sadly, in 2003, Beth died of cancer. Tom Sr. died in 2006. They started this project called the Cover-Up Quilt, which they made in 1991, where you would like sew a quilt square for your loved one who you think their death was was covered up by police.
That's something to look into. I mean, I know that it's defunct now, but
yeah,
I couldn't imagine the stories.
I couldn't find
associated.
Anything. I couldn't find a picture. I found a few articles, but they also co-founded a group called Parents Against Corruption and Cover Up. But like you said, they are both now defunct. So yeah. Then that's kind of where we end with Tommy. Nothing more was ever done about it. And oh, it's just a sad story.
Yeah. It's definitely, it shows that sometimes the abuse of power really, you know, is well abused. It's just a perfect example of, I think, laziness and really just corruption.
Yeah, I agree.
And I do not believe that one spokesperson for the police.
Oh, you know what he's doing now? He's like one of these guys that's super into bicycling. So obnoxious. He's always
racing?
Yeah. Like on Facebook, he'll have like pictures of him with like that Under Armour type stuff. And he's like wearing his bib and he's like, yeah, you know.
I'm clicking it just real quick. I always need to know if I know them. But it's like always creepy if I think that. No, I don't know this old guy. It's a liar. So, maybe he's lying. I don't think he believes what he was saying. So,
yeah.
Poverty Island. This is something that we can glare over kind of quickly.
Yeah.
There was a rumor of 5 chests that would total over $400 million in 1990s money that was sent to east of Wisconsin on a little island called Poverty Island. Sounds like a fun place. This is money that was supposed to help finance the South, I believe, in the Civil War. Yeah.
Exactly.
It's a lot of money. You know, I don't know whether it was gold. Was it gold?
They said it was like all sorts of things.
All types of things. You got gold. Give me that ruby and throw in, yeah. You know, this diamond leash. So there are things like this that happen here on Long Island all the time. Long Island in the Long Island Sound, which is a little body of water that separates Long Island and Connecticut. And there were all these pirate ships that went down there. And there's always stories if you just type Long Island Sound treasures. So people are even out probably today looking for these treasures out there. And this is just one of those kind of stories. These people, they try to find these buried treasures or what else would you call these? Just sunken treasures.
Mm-hmm.
So this guy spends about $100,000, Richard Bennett, spends $100,000 of his own money trying to track it down, which is, if he were to find it, it's a pretty decent investment.
Mm-hmm.
I cracked up when you pointed out that he came up with an ingenious water sled, which, and you wrote, it's a few pieces of PVC.
That's all it was.
It's all it is. It literally is something you can make at Home Depot for probably about $40.
Exactly. Basically, like he and one other guy grab on. It looks like the pie symbol made out of PVC. Yeah. So he grabs onto one leg of the pie. The other guy grabs onto another and they're scuba diving down. And the point is to just go like spot by spot all the way down like Poverty Island to try and see where the treasure is.
Now, I know we're going long with this episode, so I'm going to try to sum it up. But I do have one question. So my favorite layer, Jack, when he's out on the airboat, Has he ever found anything? Has he ever, I don't know.
Every day.
Really? Like,
oh yeah.
Like iPhones and stuff, or does he find,
yeah, iPhones, AirPods, mainly hats, a lot of hats that get blown off people, fishing lures. Like, he finds all kinds of stuff.
Oh my God. No, I he's the first person I thought of, because I was thinking, couldn't you take some of this money, right? Have you ever gone metal detecting?
Yes, it's so fun.
Yeah, me too. I we love doing it whenever we find the time to do it, but and whenever we have the right batteries for our metal detector, whenever we want to do it, it's like, oh, we need 9 volts. I don't want to go to the store. So couldn't he have created some type of underwater metal detector that detects gold and just kind of go across the water? I mean, you could just bring it way down there. That makes sense to me. I don't know. But I don't know enough about this type of thing. But the thing that's really kind of interesting about this particular prize, this treasure, is it's been found and lost. What was it, 2 times or 3 times? Well, 3 times total.
Twice, I think.
Well, the original time, there's a time where the chain broke, and then there's a time where a kid thinks that he saw people finding it, and then it went down.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, you're right. So they went, this kid's watching these guys try and find the treasure, and then all of a sudden they're like, woohoo, yeah, good job, we got it. And then that night, like, their whole ship sank.
I was like, oh, and these guys couldn't swim to shore? Come on.
I know, I guess not. So, yeah, he's never found the treasure. 2020 update. Yeah,
I was going to say, you have an update.
Yeah, update. No, there's no treasure.
Still no treasure. No treasure. keep dredging the water.
So good luck.
Yeah, I mean, it's just kind of interesting. I guess if you have the money, which you probably, I mean, if he's spending this kind of money, I'm imagining he's probably having a good time trying to find it. Or
he's
not.
He's still actively trying to find it. You can find him on the unsolved.com page. He responds to all the comments
on it. Can we donate money?
Oh my God, no way. No, you can, but.
Think about it. That is the ultimate scam right there. What he should do is sell shares of the final, you know, prize, if you want to call
fortune.
It. So yeah. I mean, you say, hey, look, you know, if you want to buy in on the treasure, 10 grand.
Love that.
I'm not getting in on that Ponzi scheme though. But
yeah,
it's a decent
move
idea.
Now back to the 70s.
Right. Yeah.
Sorry, 1979.
April of 1979.
Yeah, into the woods.
Yeah, this
so
is a big
we have
story.
Yeah, we have drunk 29-year-old Timothy Berry bangs on the door of a Catholic church in Everett, Massachusetts. He confesses to his priest, because Catholic guilt, that he kidnapped his sister-in-law, who is 23-year-old Nancy Brown, and he kidnapped her 16 months ago.
This poor kid. I mean, all right, she's 23, she's a woman, but I mean, she just seemed like this goofy woman who just wanted to live her life, and she...
The reenactment was really hard to watch.
I found the whole thing to be so sad, because basically Timothy Berry marries Nancy's older sister.
Yeah,
and
Andrea.
Timothy becomes the brother that they never had. Did they have another brother?
Nope, it was all girls.
So it's all girls. It just... Oh, my God. The guy becomes a real part of the family. When the father dies, he kind of steps up and he becomes the leader of the family type of role. Mm-hmm. And for this to be the outcome, for him to just flat out, you know, murder this poor girl, it's without a motive at the end of the day. I don't know. It's very heartbreaking.
Well, basically, spoiler alert. It was
I'm
Nancy's...
sorry. All right. Well, no, we knew there would be murder.
Yeah, true. So it's Nancy's day off. It's Thursday, October 6, 1977. But we have a 16-year-old Mara, who's her sister, was homesick from school. And Mara reports hearing Nancy slam the back door and turn on the kitchen radio. And that's the last time anybody heard Nancy. And no one has seen her since. So Tim and his wife, Andrea, who's Nancy's sister, and another sister, Allison, rush over to the house. You know, they're calling all her friends. Have you seen her? Where's Nancy? And at this time, Andrea and Allison are both 8 months pregnant.
Oh, God.
Because, again, Catholics.
Yes.
So,
Irish, too. Yeah.
Exactly. And as an Irish Catholic, raised Irish Catholic, I'm allowed to say these things. So,
well, Andrea, I just want to also say that we know a lot of Irish people. Like, here, there's a lot of Irish people. So they have a lot of kids. Like, holy cow, Irish people have big families.
Oh, yeah.
We thought the Orthodox had big families. But, wow. We're talking like 12 kids. You know, it's crazy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
you know, exactly. Do you come from a family that big?
I have three siblings, and we're four girls, so just this story.
Oh, look at you. You're like a fairy tale.
Well, Andrea says that in hindsight, like, she noticed him was kind of more nervous than everybody else was. So in the basement, Nancy's mom, Ida, goes down and she finds Nancy's glasses. And Nancy was like blind as a bat without these glasses.
Thomas J. needs his glasses. It reminded me of this type of thing because she's as blind as a bat without the glasses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the police get involved. And on the second day, they find her car in an abandoned shopping mall parking lot. But it was Tim who suggested that they even look in the shopping mall. So her car was unlocked. The keys are under the seat. There's no signs of foul play. There's like a few grains of sand in the car, and the car alarm was not turned on. So, like, super pregnant Andrea is just like, oh, I wish Nancy was here to see the baby. And Tim's like, she's gone. There's nothing we can do about it.
I was like, what a dick. Like, I was just oh, my God. Like, and he's just sitting there nursing his Budweiser.
Exactly. And they're like, he began to drink more heavily. Like, it was all kind of weird. So Andrea didn't know this, but the police had actually asked him to come down and take a polygraph, and he refused. So police began looking into Tim, and they find that when he was stationed in Germany for the army, he was charged with the murder of another soldier. And they called him clairvoyant because... Oh, sorry.
No, it's fine. We're cutting out, but I'm hoping that the end result will be okay. Do we know how that soldier was murdered?
No, I couldn't find anything about that. I looked too. Super sealed.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it was friendly fire or something like that.
No, oh, no, no. This is intentional murder. Like,
no, well, I mean, friendly fire to me is always like a red flag for being shot to death.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, I think that in my mind, they were like out on the bar, you know, having a good time and shot. Okay. So the military jury is like, he must be clairvoyant because he told us exactly where the body was and exactly where the murder weapon was. But apparently that wasn't enough evidence to convict him. So back to the church where Tim's confessing. He says that he knew Nancy would do laundry at her mother's house. He donned a fake mustache so the neighbors wouldn't recognize him. And then he puts like a ski mask over his head, snuck over at 5 a.m. and waited under the stairs for Nancy to do her laundry. Ugh.
But we don't know why, which is...
I feel like I know why.
Do you think that it was kind of a relationship between the two or just a rape? Or like, I don't know.
I think he... Okay, so he ends up sneaking up behind her. He blindfolded her and he threw her in the car and made her lay down in the front seat so nobody would recognize her. I think he was going to rape her. That's why he knocked her glasses off so she couldn't identify him. He took the mustache, the ski mask. I think he was trying to do like an anonymous rape. And when they show us her in the car, she's like, I know it's you, Timmy. Like, stop. Why are you doing this? I know it's you. So I think that's why he killed her.
Holy cow.
That's just my projecting. There is no evidence
to
prove that.
No, I agree with you. I'm right on board with it. It makes sense.
So he ended up driving her to a beach in Ipswich, which is 20 miles away. And they had to go like through the dunes. There's this nice wooded area behind it. I took pictures on Google Street View and I'll post a picture on Facebook. So he brought with him a hunting knife and a shovel. And he says in his confession that when she stood up to him, he hit her in the head with a shovel and slit her throat. So he buried her. He buried the knife. And the priest was like, this is really good that you're getting this off the chest, my child. But, like, maybe you should tell the police.
Did you think he was going to kill the priest?
No. Oh, God, no.
Oh, I
not
totally
a good
thought.
Boy.
I thought he was going to do it. I mean, then I have to remember it's not a movie. But, I mean, it's... Yeah. I don't know. I just feel like you're telling somebody this. Now what do you do with them?
Yeah. I don't know, but I mean, if your Catholic guilt is so bad that like years later you're going to tell a priest, I don't think that you're going to kill that guy.
I guess.
He ended up going to the authorities and the authorities are like, why didn't you tell us this? We've interviewed you.
We asked
you to take the polygraph. And he goes, well, you didn't ask me if I killed her outright. Like if you asked me, I would have told you the truth, obviously. Such crap. It's so ridiculous.
Me. Nobody said I couldn't do it. You know, it's
yeah.
Such nonsense. It's
something a kid would say if they were caught. Like, you didn't ask me directly.
I wonder, in this sick person's head, is he thinking, well, you know what? And maybe this is the way he kind of got through the day. He's kind of like, look, if they ask me flat out, did I kill her? I'll say yes.
I don't know.
And of course nobody's going to do that because you can't.
Yeah, so, like, I'm so... It's just so preposterous. So,
yes.
Like, he's with the police, and after an hour, he brought the police to where he had killed and buried Nancy. But he was like, one thing I will never tell you is why I did it. I will not tell you why. And again, if we're going back to Catholic, and your sexual urges are the devil, and you should be ashamed of yourself, is that what, you know, is if he was trying to rape her, is that why he didn't want to say it?
Right. I mean, what else would it be? Like, you know, she owed you $5. Like, I mean, it's either going to be something that you can't even go public with, or it's something ridiculous, which I just think it's the thing to be most shameful of, and that's the fact that you were going to rape her.
And, like, I know about prison, you don't want to be a rapist in there. That's usually not good for you. So, in 1980, he's convicted of second-degree murder and kidnapping, and he's sentenced to life with the possibility of parole plus 5 to 10 years. So, yeah. For 8 years, they say he's like a great dad to his kids, even on the inside, and
strange.
He's a model.
It's a very strange thing to say.
I know, and it's Andrea saying this, and it's like, he killed your sister, like,
right? And the aunt, you know, it's like your children's aunt was murdered, and it's just, you don't give this person the respect that he seems to be receiving.
I totally agree. And in November 1988, election day, we got like Bush Quayle, I think.
Yeah, did you see that in the front? Was it Quayle?
Yeah. Yeah. And like, this is only 6 years before he's eligible for parole, but he's like a trustee because he's such a good guy. So he is like painting the downtown offices. And the reason we say Bush Quayle is because it's election day.
Yeah.
And he's painting the offices in downtown Boston. So they just have like a group of trusted prisoners in just casual clothing painting. And the office was busier than usual because a lot of people would go there to cast their ballots. So he told the officer, he's like, look, I got to go to the can. Like, that's what they
he literally said that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so he's like, all right, go ahead. So like after 15 minutes, he's like, TikTok, like, I don't know what's going on with that guy. He's either pooping his brains out or he's disappeared. So like, they can't find him anywhere. A year and a half later, he just pops out of the woods in Vermont, and he just walks out of the woods to his sister-in-law's house, Allison, and he knew the kids were there, and the kids were going to be there unattended. So he sees his children and, like, kisses them and hugs them, and he's like, oh, I can only hang out here for, like, 10 minutes, and after that, you will never see me again. I have to go on the lam. So that's the last time anyone saw him, but update, because...
Well, I would have ran, personally.
If my dad comes straggling out of the woods, I know something's going on. Well, crazy.
Well, here's the thing. If your dad comes out of the woods, right, after escaping from prison a year and a half ago, where he was put in there for killing my aunt, I don't know. I wouldn't have said, hey, Dad, how are you?
Yeah. Family ties don't mean that much to him, apparently.
Yeah, I guess. It's an Irish... bond, I guess.
Well, because of Unsolved Mysteries, Tim was recaptured in Akron, Ohio. He was working as a truck driver under the name John Prendeville, and he was sent back to Massachusetts to serve out the rest of his sentence. Now, I could not find anything about this family. I mean, I found like Andrea's Facebook and their kids and stuff, but the only thing I can ever find on Tim that's not related to Unsolved Mysteries is that he appealed his conviction in 2009, 2013, saying that he pled guilty because prosecutors promised him that he would get parole after 15 years. They were both denied.
Yeah.
But I can't, he joined some kind of program, because apparently he's a trustee again, where he can make paintings and like sell them.
What?
So this furniture store in New Hampshire, I guess he's stationed in New Hampshire, they sell only stuff from New Hampshire. They have like a whole art gallery of just these like prisoners' drawings. And he like paints pictures of like lakes and like a rusty old truck. And to be honest with you, it's nothing to really write home about. I'm sure it occupies his days. But yeah, I guess you can sell it. They get to keep 90% of the proceeds. 10% goes to the Department of Corrections. And he's in New Hampshire, from what I can tell from that. Now, I can't find him anywhere. So either he is out Or he may have died in 2018, but I'm not super confident on that. But there was a man named Timothy Berry who died in 2018 in the Department of Corrections in New Hampshire.
Hmm. Well, I don't know. This guy just definitely, I mean, it's one of those type of things where you make a really screwed up decision to do something really heinous, mm-hmm. and you ruin your entire life just because of these like strange and, you know, terrible urges.
Now, this is like internalized sexism to me. I was just assuming that the soldier that he was found innocent of killing is a man. Is it possible that it was a woman?
I was thinking that. Yeah, I was thinking that when we were just talking about it. Yeah, I mean, women were definitely, it was definitely a co-ed type situation for the period of time that he was there, probably.
This is all food for thought. I really couldn't find anything about it, but...
And it would be something that would get covered up, kind of, because the last thing you want to do is find out that all these rapes are going on in the military, and of course we do have learned that those are things that are happening.
Exactly. And you know, like, it is one moment of his life, you know, that he obviously made the wrong decision and he's paying for, but, I mean, it's not like he was a shining star of a human being before when you take into account the military stuff.
Yeah. It just seemed as though he was a really nice person to the family at first. Yeah. And he just really turned on them.
So sad.
Yeah. Well, let's hope he's gone.
And
he can no longer hurt anyone. But but he definitely left his mark. There's no doubt about it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Kim, thank you very much for this. This episode went very long, but that's just
gosh,
life.
I'm sweating.
Oh, I'm sorry. but thank you very much. I appreciate all the work that you put into these episodes, and I'm looking forward to all of these next episodes that we're choosing. We're choosing so many different things, doing so much research, and I'm really happy. This is episode 21, by the way, I believe.
Woohoo! I know. And by the way, the pleasure is all mine. I hope that we did these stories justice. Obviously, we were trying to kind of condense it because we could probably spend 3 hours talking about it.
Tonight, we have been confronted with an entire catalog of unexplained and unsolved events. Tune in next time as Unsolved Mysteries Rewind discusses another collection of unsolved mysteries. Until then, we can only look and wonder.